Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Wayne Kramer begins his new memoir, The Hard Stuff, Dope Crime, the MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities, with the story of witnessing a riot when he was 19. He was a founding member of the Motor City 5, MC5 for short, and one of the band's concerts ended with mounted police swinging billy clubs at lingering concertgoers. It was in Detroit in 1967, and only a lead-up to the violence that left 43 people dead and the city in ruins that summer. He goes on to trace the brief but incendiary career of the MC5, a band that was hounded by authorities who objected to their anti-authoritarian stance and their heavy drug use, and discusses a lifetime spent pushing the boundaries of music and society, chronicling his own drug bust, time in prison, and his long road back to sobriety, music, and peace of mind. It's published by DeCapo Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Wayne Kramer to our show. Welcome.
Thank you, Leonard. I'm thrilled to be here. WBAI has a warm spot in my heart. You know, it's one of the few radio stations that's maintained its integrity and its independence. It's a great honor for me to be here with you. Thank you.
Why did you begin the book with that story? Because after that, that's the epilogue, and then you go back to I was born and yeah. I grew up and...
Because often in storytelling, it's better to start in the middle and then work your way ahead in time and back in time.
And 1967 was really the year when things just started changing.
Yeah. It's when the kind of national consciousness about... The war in Vietnam, about civil rights, about outdated sexual mores. There's an entire, the baby boomers, my generation, were coming of age, and we rejected most of the 50s mentality.
And there was a sense at the time that things were really going to change and move to the left. It's hard to believe today that Thunderclap Newman's The Revolution's Here was a number one hit. Maybe now the alt-right would want to use it rather than right. People on the left.
Right, yes. We're in, it's interesting to me because there's some parallels between 2018 and 68. In both instances, we have a wretched grifter in the White House with complete, utter disregard for the rule of law. We have corruption from the halls of Congress all the way down to the local city councils. And we have a war going on the other side of the planet, reflecting an incoherent policy for 17 years. And yet here we are 50 years later. I found it shocking that this idea that American politics swings 5 degrees, depending on the administration, you know, and we swung 5 degrees to the heights of Barack Obama. I mean, I adored Barack Obama. I thought, finally, a constitutional scholar, a man that understands international diplomacy. He's lived around the world. He's a worldly wise fellow. He's the right guy for the job. And then watch the pendulum not swing to the right, but get ripped off the clock and get smashed against the wall with this moron that we ended up with.
Well, he's been around the world as well, playing golf pretty much everywhere. Usually in his own golf courses.
You're right.
You've got a lot going on these days. You're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the release of the MC5's first album with a tour called MC50 that kicks off next month
mm-hmm.
and runs
yeah.
through October. Then you're going to Europe with it?
Correct, yeah.
Then you have this memoir, which is receiving great reviews. It's actually being released today.
Today's pub day.
And today's also your son Francis's fifth birthday?
Yep, yeah, auspicious day.
All that for a man who just recently turned 70.
Correct, correct. I'm a late bloomer.
Well, you've been active for years, but this is a whole other level.
Well, I've been fortunate, you know. I've been lucky.
How long have you been thinking about writing down your story? Because I would imagine, considering how much you were using drugs over the years, you might not remember everything.
You could imagine that, but, you know, I remember a lot. I mean, there's certainly nights that I remember the beginning of the night. I don't remember what happened the rest of the night, but I remember starting out that night. Probably about, I don't know, my friends have been bugging me for about 15 years. You know, Wayne, why don't you write this stuff down? Write it down.
Because you were telling the stories and
yeah, you know, you're
keeping
talking,
them amused.
Yeah, you're amusing your friends and being a junior raconteur. And I thought, well, okay, listen, I've made it this far. Because the tricky thing is you might die and then you missed your chance. So I figured I better get to work on it. And I started about 7 years ago. Just things would come to me. I'd write them down. And then it started to, I had 100,000 words written. And my wife said, okay, you proved you're going to really do this. So let me go find you an agent. And
cut it down
yeah,
to book
oh, yeah,
size.
Right. Yes, indeed.
You don't go easy on yourself in this book. What do you hope readers of your story will take away?
Well, you know, there's always the possibility of turning dirt into gold. And I thought all this bad behavior, all these terrible mistakes I made, maybe if I write them down and I tell the truth, it might help somebody who finds themselves in this not dissimilar situation, that I could say the one thing to them that many other people couldn't say, which is, I know how you feel. I did that too. That hopefully, you know, or you may not know that most of us don't find a way out of addiction by ourselves. We usually need the help of other people. I certainly did. And I'm really just trying to pass along the service that was extended to me.
And you give credit to a lot of wonderful people along the way.
I've been very fortunate, yes.
You grew up in Detroit, and Detroit has a unique personality, just as New York and Chicago and Los Angeles do.
Right.
But what did that mean for you? It was even though we think of it in terms of the automobile industry, awful lot of music.
Yeah, I think Detroit shows up in the music and this idea of the nobility of hard labor, that working hard was an honorable thing, and you know that's what Berry Gordy did at Motown. He created a factory where artists could work hard, and that was the approach that I took with the MC5. That we worked hard on our music. And I think that kind of goes across the board. Detroit's such a hard place to make anything happen, especially in the arts, that you have to really be committed to accomplish anything.
But when you cite your influences, you don't mention any of the Motown people in this book. Did that strike you? Did that seem to you to be the different kind of rock and roll?
No,
for you, it was Chuck Berry and Little Richard and the Rolling Stones and then a bunch of jazz people, really cutting-edge jazz people, John Coltrane, Albert Eiler, you say, Sun Ra, Motown.
I suppose, in fairness, that was an oversight on my part. I probably did not give the Motown musicians enough space, you know, because they were huge.
the greatest rhythm section in rock and roll at the time.
In the world, yes. Probably the best band, the Funk Brothers are the best band in the world.
Well,
the Beatles were a pretty good band, and they sang and wrote their own songs.
Yes.
But
Muscle Shoals had a pretty good band, too. There were a few others, and the guys in Los Angeles. But
the Motown band, those guys, you know, because they were beboppers, really, and they didn't play down to pop music. They applied everything they knew about harmony and syncopation to the pop music they were recording. They were a huge influence on me. I mean, I would see Motown session guys at the music store, and, you know, they would be like grown men, and I was a boy, and like, go talk to Babbitt. No, he's too scary looking, you know. I'm afraid of talking to him. He looks mean, you know. And Jamerson's bass playing, we all sat in awe of Jamerson's playing.
And then, of course, you also were in a town with some really influential gospel churches. C.L. Franklin had his church there, and his daughter, Aretha, turned out to be one of the most important singers.
She turned out to be a pretty good singer herself.
Really sad to hear the latest news about her.
Yeah, she doesn't look like she's very well. I used to listen to gospel radio. There was a program called Gospel Sunrise, broadcast live, and I was just mesmerized by the interaction and the connection between the preacher and the congregation, and how close they were. I mean, breath by breath, they were on the same vibration. It was very compelling to me.
C.L. Franklin was a great singer, and he wasn't doing rap, he was singing.
Yeah. It was the kind of one of the models that I invoked in the MC5. I wanted to have that spiritual vibe, you know, without the baggage of Christianity and all that woo-woo.
Your father left your family when you were quite young. In retrospect, how much do you think that affected you and how your life turned out?
I think everything that happens to kids affects them. You know, I think we're starting to get a grip on it today when we talk about childhood trauma. You know, I work in the prisons today. We run a nonprofit that works
with
prisoners.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
And I've never met a prisoner who didn't suffer childhood trauma. You know, for me, I just didn't have a father to model what being a man meant. You know, I had a mother, and she was terrific, and she tried to be a mom and a pop, but she can't. She can only be a mom. And so to have that kind of vacuum there, I think had something to do with my need to be in a band and stand up on a stage and demand that 1,000 people shower me with affection. Something was missing that I was, there was a hole I was trying to fill.
There's a passage early in the book about when you were 14 and your mother sat you down to talk about your desire to be a musician and the type of lifestyle such a career would mean. What did she tell you? And what was your reaction?
She said, Wayne, you know, I want you to be happy with your life, and I want you to do what you want to do. But this business about being a musician, this is a hard life. You know, you'll probably have to work at night and sleep during the day.
Most musicians do.
And there are drugs and alcohol in that world, you know, of nightclubs. And Wayne, there are loose women that associate with musicians. And if I wasn't sold before I had the talk, I was sold afterwards. I said, don't throw me in that briar patch.
How old were you when you picked up a guitar?
10.
And how soon did you know that playing music was what you wanted to do as a career?
I think the idea was always there from the beginning. You know, I saw the power of it. How my mother was dating a guy from the South, and he would come over with his guitar and he would serenade her in the living room, and I'd sit and watch, and I could see she was falling for this, you know, and this guy was getting over, and I didn't like the guy, and
never did come to like him.
Never did like him, but she did, and I thought, wow, this is some powerful stuff. And there was this young guy named Elvis Presley, who had a name unlike any name I had ever heard before in my upbringing in Detroit. I didn't know anyone named Elvis, but here was this guy named Elvis who had a phenomenal voice, and young people were going crazy for him, and I started to think, there might be something to this guitar singing, dancing thing.
You met your bandmate Fred Sonic Smith at Lincoln Park High School. What kind of kid was Fred?
Fred was a juvenile delinquent. he ultimately soon thereafter dropped out of high school, and he was defiant and hilariously funny and
played guitar well.
He actually did. You know, he didn't. I was a few years ahead of him, so I spent one summer showing him everything I knew, and he was a natural musician and really took to the guitar and you know, ultimately became a really proficient guitarist and unique with his own voice and a terrific songwriter.
Rob Tyner, who became the lead singer for the MC5, lived in your neighborhood. Why did he need to be convinced to join the band?
Because he thought rock and roll was corny teenage stuff, you know. He said, you should be listening to Cannonball Adderley, man. You should listen to Mingus. That Chuck Berry stuff, that's teenage, you know.
Not bad advice, actually. They were great musicians.
It was good advice, but I knew, you know, I tried to convince him how much fun it is when you're up on stage and you're sweating and you're doing your dance steps and the lights and the kids are dancing. And finally, one day, he came around and he asked me if I was still doing my band, and he wanted to come over and check us out. And he became the bass player in the band for a while.
And then you got another bassist, Michael Davis, and your drummer, Dennis Machine Gun Thompson.
Yeah.
Were they just around? And
they were Dennis was in the neighborhood. He was the paper boy. He would come by to collect for the newspaper, and I'd be playing my, hey, you play guitar? Yeah, I play drums. Oh, really? And we should get together. So when we had a couple other guys on the band, and they left, and then I needed another drummer, so I remembered the kid that used to deliver the papers, and I called him up, and he came out, and he worked out fine. And Michael Davis was a friend of Tyner's from down from the Wayne State University area. They had already moved out and were living on their own in apartments downtown. Art student, beatnik art student, Michael Davis.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm speaking with Wayne Kramer, who's written a memoir, The Hard Stuff, Dope Crime, The MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities. Did you start playing covers, or did you try to write and perform your own songs?
We started playing covers. I think if you trace it, any musician or any band, it's always the same story. It's the same for all of us. You play what your idols are playing. You play what you can, you know, with your technical ability. And then at a certain point, you kind of master being a cover artist, and then you realize that there's not much of a future in that, or there's a limited future in that. And if you want to play concerts and have your music on the radio, then you have to start writing songs.
And you quickly earned a reputation as a great live band. How would you describe your live act?
I think it was like James Brown gets a Marshall amplifier on acid.
Did you do the whole thing with James the jacket?
James Brown with Bobby Seale and James, you know, and a healthy dose of LSD. My idea was that it was all movement, all excitement, all dance, everything that I saw in the world around me that inspired me, certainly James Brown, certainly the Motown artists, you know, their ability to dance together and what I felt in that black gospel music, that the sanctified spirit. And then when I added all that with the influence of the free jazz movement, you know, of Albert Eiler and Train and Sun Ra and Archie Shepp and Pharoah Sanders, then I knew where the future was going.
Well, how did that speak to you as a guitar player?
Showed me where to go, showed me where the future was. I mean, if I was at a point where I could take my best Chuck Berry type playing. I could be playing with the maximum velocity. I turn the amp as high as I can, fast as I can, and where do I go from there? What's the next step? And that's what Pharoah Sanders showed me. That's what Archie Shepp showed me.
But you didn't become a jazz group.
No, We were a rock band. We were, you know, we were trained as rock musicians, and we were happy being a rock musician. I didn't learn to play bebop until years later when I was in the penitentiary with Red Rodney.
Because he was one of the great bebop trumpet players. He had played with Charlie Parker. Some of the big bands of the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, he played with everybody, yeah. His first professional gig was with Gene Krupa.
Mm. I met him many years later when he was... he had a group with Ira Sullivan, an extraordinary musician who could play both trumpet and saxophones.
Yeah, brass and reeds. Yeah, he was...
That's very
Ira
rare.
Sullivan, phenomenal.
John Sinclair was a young poet in the mid-60s living in Detroit. How did you meet him, and how did he come to be the manager of the MC5?
Well, Tyner met him first. John ran a group called the Artist Workshop, which was a... association of poets and avant-garde jazz musicians and dancers and they would do weekly events, poetry readings with live music, and Tyner started attending these things downtown, and he'd come back and tell us, you know, you guys got to come and see this. This is fantastic, and there's this guy Sinclair, and he's a poet, and so. I was 17 when I left home, and I moved down to that neighborhood because you could rent an apartment cheap. $10 a week was my rent.
Wow.
One-bedroom apartment with a hot plate and my own bathroom, even. I followed Sinclair. He had a column in the local underground newspaper, and he talked about the Artist Workshop as being a community-based enterprise, and I said, you know, we're a community band. I'm a community musician, and could we have access to the space to rehearse in? And he said, come on in, let's smoke a joint. We'll talk about it.
He was very political. Did he influence the band, or was the band already moving in that direction?
I think we were moving in that direction, but just on an intuitive gut level. You know, I knew life wasn't fair. I knew the war was wrong. I knew people of color were not enjoying equal rights and equal justice. But I couldn't really articulate much of it. John was a little older and better educated and had a very clear and compelling vision and analysis of the world around us. And so that was very attractive. I was drawn to him, and I embraced many of John's political positions.
You were all living in downtown Detroit during the summer of 1967 when the city went up in flames following a police raid on an after-hours club in the black community. What do you remember about those 3 days and nights and the riots? Did they affect the band? And continue and talk about how the cops came to your performance and started bashing people in the audience.
Well,
and you were white.
Yeah, it was a week. It was an entire week. The city of Detroit was literally at war for a week, or under siege. Gunfire was constant for a week. Sirens.
Who
smoked.
Started it?
The police.
And why? Were they just upset that they didn't have total control? I mean, we're seeing problems right now again. There's quite a bit of tension between some communities and police forces.
Because the mentality in America, in American police in the 1960s, was they were the biggest gang in town. And they did things the way they wanted to do it, when they wanted to do it, to whom they wanted to do it. And they had been oppressing certainly the black community for time immemorial in Detroit. The history of Detroit police in the black community was rife with just experience after experience after experience. And, you know, or maybe most people don't know, people of color in Detroit did not share in the prosperity on an equal footing as whites did with the emergence of the big three automakers, and see the USA and your Chevrolet and all this grand.
Well, Ford had actually encouraged black people to come from the South and go up to Detroit because he felt that they would be they would appreciate that they got the job, and they wouldn't join the union, and they wouldn't give him any trouble.
Yeah, he'd appreciate it. Last hired,
didn't always happen.
Last hired, first fired, and got the worst jobs on the shop floor, the most dangerous jobs. Got crossed out of the union participation, got crossed out of political participation and economic benefits. So, you know, they were already mad and had been mad. And like people of color across the country, I mean, America, the whole country just about went up in flames that summer. And, you know, you can only keep your boot on someone's neck so long. And sooner or later, their humanity demands that they strike back.
In 1968, John Sinclair, along with his wife, Lenny, and Pun Plamondon, formed the far-left anti-racist White Panther Party. Some people misunderstand that name and think that it has that it's a white supremacist group, but they were trying to be just like the Black Panthers. How involved were you and the other members of the band with the White Panthers?
I was right there from the beginning. We were officially designated ministers of culture in the streets. And I embraced membership in the White Panther Party. You know, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale had put out a call for there to be a group in the white community to do parallel but separate work. And we said that was us, that, you know, that's me. And it gave me a lot of it, to be honest, was reefer smoking, hilarious agitprop theater. And we thought that this is all as silly as it sounded. But there was also a serious side to it because it gave us a chance to express our frustration.
Is it what led the FBI to become interested in your band's activities?
Yeah. Yeah, we know now from Freedom of Information requests that we've got. I've all my FBI papers and highly redacted files. Where they were tapping our phones, and they'd follow us on gigs, and they had all our propaganda. And, you know, when you say you're going to do everything you can to destroy the government, they take you seriously, and they will use everything they have against you.
What ways did the band's political positions influence its ability to break through commercially? Do you think people were afraid to hire you or to promote you?
I think they liked it in the beginning, but when it turned out to be serious, they decided that they'd rather go back and just sell a lot of records. You know, Elektra Records said they stood behind us. They believed in freedom of speech, that artists could say what they want. But then when we said what we wanted in an ad against a store that wouldn't sell our record, they got all bent out of shape and fired us from the record label.
I'm speaking with Wayne Kramer. He's written a memoir called The Hard Stuff, Dope, Crime, The MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities. It's published by DeCapo Press.
Yes.
You must have been aware that was going to cause trouble.
Of course. We weren't stupid. I mean, we knew that Kick Out the Jams, MF, would never be a hit single on the radio. That's why we recorded a version that said Kick Out the Jams, Brothers and Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
We had a plan in mind, and the plan was to let the single peak in the charts, let it come down out of the charts until everyone knew we were a bona fide hit band, then release the album, and there would be no stopping us. Unfortunately, they rushed the album out and ended up getting us banned from the radio for life.
Well, this month marks the 50th anniversary of the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and one of the key events of the late 1960s. Abbie Hoffman had organized a festival of life to attract young people to come to Chicago during the convention. Wasn't MC5 the only band that showed up to play?
Yes.
What were the conditions like in Grant Park, and what do you remember about that performance? That was before Kick Out the Jams was released, wasn't
it? Yeah. Well, it wasn't out of the ordinary for us. We played anywhere, anytime anyone would let us, and if someone wanted us to play a benefit to raise money for someone that was arrested or sympathetic politician. We would play for them. We were happy to contribute, and to go out to Chicago and play with Abby and Jerry and the pig, and you know, it sounded like a ball. All the West Coast bands said they were going to come, but I think they came to their senses and realized that the Chicago Police Department had nightsticks in store for them. And so they all stayed home, and the MC5 was the only band to play. We showed up, and the police wouldn't allow a flatbed truck to enter the park. So we set up on the ground, and there was no generator. So we had to take an extension cord over to the hot dog stand and ask the guy, can I plug this in here so we can run our sound system? You know? And we rocked it. We did a 45-minute show, and it was a kind of surreal experience, because people weren't – there wasn't a lot of smiling going on. People weren't – there wasn't good vibes. The Chicago police were sending motorcycle police through the crowd, roughly, you know, like knocking people over. And there were agents provocateur in the audience. You'd see guys with fatigue jackets and short hair punching out hippie kids, you know. And you just knew this is very heavy vibes. And, of course, the minute we stopped playing and the crowd didn't have anything to focus on, you know, many people in that crowd came to fight. And they took on the police, and the police started the rampage, and then the whole world was watching.
Are you feeling a certain sense of deja vu these days because of the conflict in Seattle and last year in Charlottesville? And although the Washington rally of the alt-right didn't really, it kind of fizzled, there's that same kind of a feeling that we are, that people are in the 60s, late 60s, it was people who supported the Vietnam War as opposed to people who were opposed. Today we have a different conflict, but it some ways it feels the same to me.
I suppose it is the same when you get mostly young men who are, you know, virile, young, and they want to get out there and prove their macho credentials. They want to fight out in the street, whether it's Antifa or the Nazis. That part of it is the same, of course, but I think it was quantitatively different in the 60s. We didn't the opposing forces were the establishment, were the police. Here we've got opposing social groups fighting with each other, which in a way, you know, I'm sure the police appreciate, because they can kind of like stand on the side and try to not get involved, like Charlottesville with the, you know, police didn't even get in the middle of it where they should have been involved in it.
John Sinclair was arrested for possession of two joints in 1969, which was the third time he had been arrested for that, sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. What effect did that have on the band?
Destroyed us. It broke our back, really, because John was the interlocutor between the band, who we were crazy, really. We were unmanageable, and the outside world. I mean, John could go talk to businessmen, he could talk to lawyers, he could talk to record company executives, he could talk to booking agents, he could talk to club owners and promoters. And we respected John. And when we lost John, you know, we tried to work with professional managers, and that never worked out for us. It just, you know, we were not good little soldiers.
You did organize a defense fund for him, and he was freed from prison in 1971. After releasing two more albums, Back in the USA in 1970 and High Times 1971, and then doing a lot of touring, the band started coming apart. What were the main reasons for the breakup in 1973?
We couldn't survive failure. You know, most bands... the arc is pretty similar. You know, the young people get together, they share a vision, they work real hard, they accomplish something, they build a following, they create some music, they achieve some recognition, then life gets complicated 4 or 5 years down the line, and then ultimately they break up.
But you also had become addicted to drugs. Well, were all the members
With the MC5, though, we had all of that, plus we had the FBI, local and state police agencies, in our grill all the time. And we had criticism, brutal criticism from our comrades on the left, let alone the criticism we got from the establishment.
But you were also engaging in criminal activity to support your habit.
Well, ultimately,
How did you rationalize that? After all, you were, to some degree, an idealist.
Yeah, rationalization and justification can take on amazing proportions, especially when you're in the midst of active opiate abuse. I justified it by telling myself that I wasn't stealing from people. I was stealing from insurance companies, and we all know they're crooks anyway. I could rationalize anything depending on what my interest in it. How did it work out for me?
Well, you wound up leading to your being busted.
Sure did. I'm not saying it's a successful MO. It blew up in my face pretty quick.
Did you ever resort to violence when you're trying to get money?
I've hurt people, and I've been hurt.
How long a sentence did you receive after you were arrested?
I got a 4-year regular adult sentence from the federal courts, and with a 3-year special parole term after that.
And you were sent to Lexington Federal Prison in Kentucky. That's where they sent drug addicts in the hopes of getting them to kick for good. Did it work? Was the program good?
No, it didn't work. The program was the mustard seed of a program. Lexington was built in the 30s in the Progressive Era as an alternative to the federal prison system for this new class of criminal, the drug addict. And they thought they would put America's best scientists on it, and we're going to crack this problem of addiction, and we're going to handle it just like we do because we're Americans and we can do this. And to their credit, they did a lot of great research, but they never did crack addiction. As we know today, addiction is a very complex mental disorder. We say it's a long walk into the woods. It's a long walk back out of the woods. And Lexington did the best they could do with the state of the art at the time.
It's there that you met Red Rodney, who became a mentor.
Indeed.
You devote a whole chapter to him. He was one of the greatest storytellers I've ever met, but I was never sure what to believe. And his approach to jazz was a far cry from Sun Ra, Albert Adler, and John Coltrane, the others you've mentioned, Pharoah Sanders. What did he teach you about music?
He was interested in the discipline, the theory. What he taught me was a Berklee School of music theory that he had taken when he had first gone to prison. He still had the coursework. Mm-hmm. And in those days, you would mail it back to your instructor. And he told me that the instructor sent him the homework assignments, and he wrote out the charts and did the harmonies and sent them back. And his teacher said, I think you might be a professional musician. And Red didn't say anything. And then the next coursework came, and he sent it back. And the guy said, I'm positive you're a professional musician. Who are you?
Well, that's good. I remember interviewing another famous jazz musician who was in jail in California a lot. And he said that since there were so many good musicians when he first started being sent to prison, he really enjoyed being in the bands, and he wasn't so sorry that he wound up going to jail. Later, when the quality of the musicians changed, he had to straighten himself out. But it sounds like you were able to grow as an artist and a musician because of Lexington.
As it turns out, it was an unexpected gift. I mean, who could have imagined that going to prison was going to end up being such a positive experience for me? Because in general, there's not much positive that happens in prisons. I don't know that prison term ever helped anybody. I'm not sure it helped me. I mean, it kept me alive during a period where I was really drinking and drugging very heavily, and my behavior and the people I associated with were all, it was very slippery, and a lot of, I could have died easily, and I didn't.
Did you go back to your addictions after your release?
I did. I came out with nothing but willpower. And willpower is not enough. I sat in there for 3 years and talked about getting straight and getting my career back on track and getting a good life together, and came out. And, first thing I did, my girlfriend was an active addict, and I joined a band with another active addict, Johnny Thunders. I mean, these were not smart career choices on my part. So, yeah, I didn't have a chance. And I stayed out for a long time. I didn't get sober till I was 50 years old.
But you finally were able to do it.
It's
people have told me it's the hardest thing in the world to do once you've been addicted for a long time.
It wasn't that hard for me. It was harder to continue to do what I was doing. Mm. I mean, that was the point I got to. In prison, there's a thing that happens with men. When they hit around age 50, we call it aging out. They kind of stop being tough guys. They stop being gangsters. They stop trying to be slick. They just want to get out of prison and have a wife and have a house and have a job and have a life. And I think that maybe something not dissimilar hit me. I'd been using drugs and drinking hard for a long time and had friends that were dropping like flies, and I wanted to live.
Human Rights Watch started a campaign a couple of years ago to try to get lifers out of prison after they reached a certain age, because they said they have matured considerably, they have no threat to society, there's absolutely no reason to keep them there and actually have them be a drain on our resources.
I have a friend who was serving life without the possibility of parole in California, and served 38 years, and his sentence was finally commuted last Christmas. He came out, and he works for us now in Jail Guitar Doors, writing grants. His name's Ken Hartman. He's an award-winning author and a father and a fantastic human being.
So let's talk about Jail Guitar Doors.
Yeah.
You've partnered with the British singer-songwriter and activist Billy Bragg to form this nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. What kind of work does it do?
What we do is simple. We find people that work in corrections that are willing to use music as a tool for rehabilitation. We provide instruments for correctional facilities, and we operate programs. We have a Jail Guitar Door songwriting curriculum program, a creative self-expression program that rehabilitates prisoners. It's used as violence prevention and reentry preparation. We find that we've perfected a curriculum that, through the process of writing songs, of telling your story, of going back and seeing where things started to go sideways for you, to be able to express complex and painful memories and emotions in a positive way in the arts, in songwriting, and that to recognize these feelings and get them out on the table and recognize the humanity that we all share can prepare people for the hard work of positive change. Because 600,000 prisoners are released every year. 99% of the people in prison are coming home someday. And if we don't help them change for the better while they're there, they will most certainly change for the worse. And we ignore that fact at our own peril.
I'm speaking with Wayne Kramer on WBAI 99.5 FM. He's written a memoir called The Hard Stuff, Dope, Crime, The MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities. You write movingly about a concert you and Billy Bragg performed with a group of rock musicians at Sing Sing Prison. Did going back into that environment stir up strong feelings and memories in you?
The first few times I went back to prison, I had a fight with my wife every time right before we got ready to leave for the prison. It was like, what's going on? Like, no matter what it was, I found something to fight about. It was, it certainly stirred up, prison experience is a traumatic thing to endure. And I'm okay today. I go in prisons all the time and I'm fine with it. Because I know the people inside are exactly the same as the people outside. You know, there's a myth about prisoners and prisons that Hollywood television films perpetrate. And, you know, part of our work is to put a human face on a prisoner.
What can you tell us about MC50? Who are the other musicians that you're playing with?
I'm so fortunate to have these guys. I have the great Kim Thiel from Soundgarden playing guitar with me. Our secret weapon, Marcus Durant from Zen Gorilla. Billy Gould, the great bassist from Faith No More. And Washington, D.C.'s Fugazi provided us with the fantastic Brendan Canty on drums. And we'll have special guests all along the tour route in the second half of the show to come up and join us on songs.
But none of the surviving members, there are only a couple of surviving members of MC5.
Me and Dennis Thompson are the only two left. And
the drummer.
Yeah, I've invited Dennis. He wanted to do it, then he didn't want to do it, then he wanted to do it, then he didn't want to do it, then he wanted to do it, then he didn't want to do it. So I don't know what the guy's deal is. You know, the invitation stands. If he wants to come and play, he's welcome to come and play.
Why didn't you and the other members of the MC5 stay in better touch after the band broke up?
The feelings were so raw and so embittered. We all worked so hard to try to make something that we felt was so important happen, and when it all failed, it was too much to bear. It was more than anyone could carry, and I think it damaged all of us individually, and the recriminations were just bottomless, you know. And so it was easier to go away from each other than it was to try to sustain a relationship.
They all died so young. Rob Tyner passed away in 1991, Fred Sonic Smith in 1994, Michael Davis most recently in 2012. Do you think it's all because you lived a hard life?
Substance abuse takes its toll on you. A body can take it for about 20 years, and then you know, your organs just can't take it anymore.
How does it feel to play MC5 music without them?
It's weird. Mm-hmm. It's weird, but, you know, when I'm playing, there's so much going on that I rarely reflect on it. I do try to pay tribute to each of them every night in the concert. I try to mention their names and honor their contribution to what we're doing. And you know, this music that's sustained all these
270.
It's the greatest. It's the coolest thing I ever did. It's the most meaningful thing I ever did. It's the most rewarding thing I ever did. I mean, I finally understand how the human species has survived. Because you get something from children that you don't get from friends, you don't get it from work, you don't get it from accomplishing things, you don't get it from money, you don't get it from travel. There's something about being responsible for another human being, a little human being, that's just terrifying and gratifying on levels that I never knew existed.
Do you think you had to wait all this time to be prepared to actually do it right?
I was too busy being a child. I figured I'm just about done being a child. Maybe now I can look after one. I can't claim maturity, you know. I know what it is, and I'd like to think I'm moving in that direction.
What are your musical tastes today?
You know, I still love the stuff I loved in the 60s. I still listen to Train and Cannonball Adderley.
But also the blues?
And the blues.
Because you were doing a lot of blues material initially.
Sure. And I've I have to work at it, but I find new artists that I love. There's a band from New Orleans called Tank and the Bangers that are my new favorites. To me, they epitomize everything I'm trying to do that matters in music. I mean, they're brilliant musicians. They understand the intersection of poetry and song and performance. There's another band called Lake Street Dive that I'm sure all my hardcore friends and fans will be upset to hear me say I like them, but I adore them. They're music students from the New England Conservatory of Music, and they write music that is straight out of 70s soul. They're a gorgeous-looking band, two women and three guys, and they sing their asses off, and they write great songs, and they actually are a band that plays music in front of people with real instruments, and they sing and play. There's another band from here in Brooklyn called the Dirty Projectors that I'm a big fan of.
Dirty Projectors?
The Dirty Projectors, yeah. The band leader, what I'm hearing is the township music from South Africa. He's kind of filtered it through the electric guitar and a Veg-O-Matic and Pro Tools and a looper, and he's come up with some really wonderful stuff. So there's good stuff out there. You know, I like a lot of what's happening in hip-hop. I think a lot of that's really adventurous.
And then people are adjusting. One of my previous shows in this series was with Aaron Neville and his wife, Sarah Friedman. He's still performing, but they are farming in upstate New York.
Good for them. I always felt like Aaron Neville should get a national grant from the government as one of our national treasures. You know, they should just give him some money to be Aaron Neville.
Do you ever go back to Detroit?
National treasure. I do. I go pretty often. In fact, I'll be back there this Saturday to do a show with John Sinclair, and then later to do a book event with Don Was and some of my fellow Detroit musicians.
So you remain in contact with John Sinclair?
I do, and...
He okay these days?
He's struggling. He's an older man now, and he's got some health challenges. But his spirit is still strong, and he's still creative. He still writes. But the thing about Detroit I wanted to mention since you brought it up is we finally launched a jail guitar doors program in the Michigan Department of Corrections in a facility in the city of Detroit, which, I mean, we've been doing this 10 years. I've been trying to get a program up in Detroit for about the last 5 years, and we finally launched it this summer. And we're working with the lifer population there, and it's going great. And I've got a great crew of local musicians that show up every week and work with the guys. And I'm really proud of that.
But Detroit has become a rather sad shadow of its former self. It was once incredibly alive city.
Oh, it was a boom.
Do you
town.
Think it'll ever recover?
I don't see it. Maybe someday it could be Portland. Mm-hmm. But it'll never be the Detroit that it was of my youth, where almost 4 million people and booming economy and bustling retail everywhere and exciting things and unlimited possibilities. That Detroit is a shadow of that. I mean, there's less than 700,000 people. Wow. There's 30% unemployment for young black men in Detroit. They're trying. You know, the hipsters are trying, the artists are trying, and I'm trying with them. But the challenge is there's no economic base there yet. You know, somebody needs to figure out how to make whizzer wheels in Detroit, and maybe we'll get a big whizzer wheel factory going and people can go back to work.
Wayne Kramer's memoir, The Hard Stuff, Dope Crime, The MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities, is published by DeCapo. Let's go out with something from the MC5, The American Ruse.
Time.
I told you in school about freedom. When you're trying to be free, they never let you. They said it's easy, nothing to it. And now the army's out to get you. 69 American terminal staff says the air's so thick it's like a drowning in molasses. I'm sick and tired of paying these dues, and I'm finally getting hip to the American Ruse.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to today's guest, Wayne Kramer of the MC5, to Todd McGovern, who produced this segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who's at the audio controls, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Let It Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Let It Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Let It Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.